Good morning. It's Saturday morning, 7:05 a.m., March 10th, 2012. I took the password off the phone, so we don't have that problem today. There may be another one, but at least that one's gone away. It was such a kick in the gut yesterday when that threw up. It just kept going throughout the day. Every time I turned around, the security password kept asking me to log back in again. It got to be such a pain in the butt, I had to take it off. It was ridiculous. I understand, because the places where it asked for the password actually made sense to ask for the password. And even when I extended the login to an hour, every once in a while it would, when I plug in to move a file on or off the machine, of course it would prompt me for it if I did anything, actually. That was not just read the next email message, it prompted me. So I wound up taking it off, which is kind of a pain in the butt. Anyway, 2 weeks from today, I fly to Oregon for the Dean Wesley Smith Catherine Rush seminar on character and setting. Yesterday they sent us details and asked us to reply to the email. And I read the email on my phone and I thought, it's kind of sparse in terms of details, but okay, I got it. But I still didn't see anywhere where we were supposed to, how we're supposed to actually pay them or when. So I sent an email off list to Dean. It turns out that because I wrote it on my phone, I didn't actually scroll down all the way. And this is not the first time that this has happened to me, where I thought I got to the bottom of the message, and in fact, what I got to was the bottom of a paragraph that happened to have an extra long white space at the end of it. And then another five or six paragraphs beyond it. So when I wrote to Dean and said, okay, I got the message, but I'm still looking for payment details. So it's in the message you just acknowledged receiving. So I had to go back and look, and sure enough, it was at the bottom. And when I looked at it online, when I looked at it on my computer screen, of course, that's a perfectly valid, very relatively short message. It's just my phone screen is so small that a couple of extra lines looks like the end of the message. And there isn't a very clear vertical scroll indicator saying, okay, you've got a lot more message to read. So I felt kind of foolish. But I sent him his payment, so he can't complain too much. And my printer shipped, so that was good. The cable shipped. Oh, shut up, dog. Stupid animal. So when I ordered the printer, one of the things I know about USB printers is that they typically don't come with cables. So the last thing I needed is to get there and not have a cable, so I ordered a cable, and a 99-cent cable. And I'm, oh, great, cool. Throw in the box, and I'll have it all together. Unfortunately, the cable came from a different company. The shipping and handling on the cable was $6. Had I known that, I'd have just thrown one in my suitcase. That was stupid. Yeah, well. I'll have to throw it in my suitcase anyway, because I'm not sure it's going to arrive in time. The printer should. The printer's supposed to arrive in 5 to 7 working days, which would be midweek, not next week, the week after, which is a few days in advance of when I actually need to have it. So that's cool. Apparently, I need to have it at the bed and breakfast and not at the offices, which I thought was strange, but okay. Dean said he would get it from one place to the other for me if I could get it delivered to the office. So there was that. Uh, It's a chilly morning this morning, and I took some pictures of my beard. For those of you who are following along on Twitter, the impetus for that is that my wife called me out on Facebook and said, "Hey, your beard's grown out. You should take some more pictures. You should put a picture on your Facebook of your beard, because right now it's still the clean-shaven Nate." And she's right. It has grown out a lot. I still like the one picture. It's an interesting picture. The first picture that I took of the beard actually had a rather profound effect on me when I saw it. And I just took some more pictures. I pushed one out to Flickr and to Twitter just for people to be able to see how it's grown out. And I did it before I started too far down the walk, so my breath hasn't frozen on the whiskers at the moment. Or at that moment. They've done so now, I think. It's quite chilly. It's 28. It feels colder. My fingers are very cold today. But it's Saturday. I got to get Mainframe ordered a hard copy of Ravenwood, and I printed out the label, and then I haven't put it in the package. I've got to get that out of here today. Also got to go play some games with the bank, because one of our accounts has fallen below minimum with no activity, so we've got to keep a minimum amount in it in order to maintain it. It's kind of a pain in the butt. So we'll go take care of that today. I need to get some writing done today. I need to bang out that story. It's only a couple 3,000 words, so I ought to be able to hammer it out if I can just sit down and focus on it for a couple 3 hours. That would pretty much take care of it. Because that'll have to be this afternoon, because this morning I've got to go deal with the post office and with the banks and all the rest. So, yeah. So what else am I thinking about today? I made a new recipe last night. Potato and leek soup. It came from I hate corned beef and cabbage, but I want to eat Irish news article about recipes. If you don't like corned beef and cabbage, what can you eat instead? Now, I happen to adore corned beef and cabbage. I'm not sure that I can actually justify corned beef and cabbage on St. Paddy's Day, just because corned beef is so filled with salt and the meat is so fatty. But I do love it. And I suppose a small portion with a lot of vegetables would probably be adequate. But I wanted to try this recipe because I do like potato soups, generally speaking. And this one did not involve pureeing the potatoes, but rather keeping them whole, diced. But and it was based heavily on vegetable stock, so it was very much a kind of vegetarian meal. I was going to put a couple rashers of bacon in just for flavoring when I sauteed the leeks, but I forgot to do it, and it came out quite nice anyway. So that was good. I think I'm going to have that one again. And I probably will do something rash, like add a can of creamed corn, because it needed a little bit of extra color, a little bit of extra texture. The leeks themselves were nice. They were flavorful, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't like an onion or anything. And the potatoes were quite tasty after having been steeped in the vegetable broth. Put about a half a cup of skim milk in to lighten it. I was supposed to use a half a cup of cream, but that ain't going to happen. So it worked out nicely. It was a nice meal last night. Some. It's because it's a little bit later. The sun is a little bit warmer, and I'm coming up on the eastern path, walking straight into the sun. It feels pretty good. Anyway, oh, fuck. Got laundry to do today. I still have that one story that I haven't done the audio edit on yet either. I've got to get that done. I didn't actually get my to-do list updated yesterday, which was rather a pain in the butt. But I did actually, stop using word actually. I did get the post ready for mwriting.org. Joanna Harness wrote to me a couple of weeks ago and said, I have you down for Monday the 15th to do a, or the 11th, whatever Monday is, 12th, to do a post for mwriting, just a reminder. And of course, I don't remember volunteering for that, but it's quite possible that she asked, can I put you down for March? And I said something like, yes, which was probably a mistake. But the good news was that I had an opportunity to talk about something that's been in the news lately, which is this Department of Justice lawsuit against Apple and the publishers involved in agency pricing. There's also an ancillary suit against Penguin and a couple of others on the practice of windowing. And what they're claiming is violations of RICO, the racketeer-influenced and corrupt, racketeer-influenced and corrupt Organization Act of 1970, which makes it illegal to collude on prices. Collude in restraint of trade is how it's technically, I think, referred to. But price fixing is generally construed to be restraint of trade. And there's a lot of hand-wringing going on, particularly on this idea of windowing. Windowing is when a company puts out the hardcover first, and then they put out the trade paperback version, and then they put out the paperback version, and then they put out the ebook version, and that's, you know, leaving room between each release in order to have time for each segment of the market to buy what they're going to buy before they release the next one. It's the fundamental basis for the cannibalization model that most publishers use. And so when people saw that the DOJ was going for these people for windowing, they immediately said, well, what about me? What if I wanted to do that? Why can't? I didn't realize this was illegal. What's up with this? The problem is, of course, that it's not windowing that's illegal. It's the collusion. And I know this sounds strange, but when I was in the textbook business back in the 70s, the margins on textbooks was 20%, so that whatever the price of the book, the bookstore got 20% of the cover price. Now, for a $100 textbook, that meant they got $20. For a $50 textbook, which is pretty common in 1975, 1976, that meant they got $5, or $10, which sounds like a lot when you consider that they've got a captive audience and the whole bit, but the problem was that 20% margin is really not enough to run a bookstore, even when you're selling a few 100,000 units a year to a captive audience. And the result was that over the mid-70s, a lot of bookstores were closing because that margin just wasn't enough. If you had one bad buy, some overly zealous instructor said 300 people were going to enroll and only 50 did, and half of them dropped, and you were stuck with all these textbooks, and in many cases would never be used again because a new edition would be out before the class cycled around. And the returns were generally not ever more than 50%. For some of them, it was 25%. So if I order 100 books, the most you can send back is 25. Well, bookstores were under pressure to order enough to cover the class because students get assignments on the very first day. So they have to have the books on the shelves and ready to go for the first day of class or before. And they have to have enough for all the people who want to buy one. And the problem is, if not everybody buys one, then the returns start eating into that 20%, and it eats in rather quickly. So one bad buy can chew up all the profit that you might have made for a whole year. And you do this three times. This is three semesters in most universities, summer, fall, and spring. And so it becomes rather a crapshoot on whether or not you can afford to actually have a bookstore run by the college and university. The advantage, of course, is that you, as college and university, you get to declare the policy, you get to control it, you get to say when it's going to be open, blah, blah, blah. And the net was that Barnes & Noble and Follett, and I think there's one more, were real big in terms of turnkey bookstore operations, where they would come into a university and they would bring in their staff, they would bring in their textbook expertise, they would bring in their huge buying leverage. So for common textbooks that get assigned in mass classes across multiple campuses, you know, they were able to order 5,000 Meigs economics books and still get, you know, 20%. In some cases, they could get a discount because they were ordering so many. And the risk of each individual purchase was then offset by the fact that if this campus didn't actually sell all of them, maybe the next campus was looking for more, and they could just transfer stock in-house. So they gave them huge leverage to come in and work in those environments. So in about 1976, 1977, the National Association of College Stores, at one of their annual conventions, decided that they needed to have a discussion about prices and margins, and they wanted 23%. And the DOJ stepped in before they were able to do anything by sending them a strongly worded cautionary note that said, this is a violation of RICO. The collusion to set prices is illegal. If each of you wants to talk about what you want to do to individual publishers and what you want to say to an individual publisher as an individual bookstore, that's fine, but you can't get together as an industry group, as an enterprise, as defined by RICO, and lay down ultimatums, terms to the suppliers in restraint of trade. Particularly where you're talking about raising the prices. Now, actually, restraint of trade also applies to lowering prices, but that's a whole different issue. Actually, it's the whole same issue. Whenever you get together and try to do as a group with a unilateral action, something that's going to affect the market as a whole, that's considered racketeering under RICO. So it was really interesting to me to hear the hand-wringing and the complete lack of understanding of what this lawsuit means. It means that this agency pricing model that the publishers have come up with is to prop up paper by keeping the prices of ebooks artificially high. Now, we can argue whether or not what the market will bear is one thing or another. And for each individual publisher to say, no, I'm not going to sell books to you unless you sign an agency agreement is one thing, but to get together as a trade group, to get together as a cartel, to get together as an enterprise, the way the Big Six did, and ultimately forced Random House into line as well, That actually is racketeering. That actually is price fixing. And because they did it as a group, it was collusion. And collusion to fix prices in restraint of trade is one of the definitions of racketeering. So I'm actually surprised that it's taken this long for the Department of Justice to get their act together to actually do this. I know back in the mid-70s, it only took them about 3 days before they wrote to the National Association of College Stores. So it was really quite interesting. It also could be that there was a lot going on behind the scenes that I wasn't aware of. I was just a textbook clerk. But it was interesting to observe. So anyway, I had an opportunity to write about that for amwriting.org. It came out pretty good. That's what I spent yesterday doing. Anyway, I made it. I'm here. I'm at the back gate. Tomorrow's another day, and I'll talk to you then.